She could hardly believe it was hers now. She belonged to it, to this chill rock with its multicolored lichens, to the trees and the grass, to the mountain itself. But by law and custom, as their saying went, it was now hers. By custom and law, she could bar anyone from trespassing here. She could fence it, shield it, build a house here that no one ever entered but herself. It had been her dearest dream once. A little cabin, one or two rooms, all to herself, with no memories in it, here in this golden place. She had been a child then. In her daydream, food had appeared on the table without any effort of hers. Breakfast had been cereal with cream and honey. Someone else, some invisible magical person, had washed the sticky bowl. She had always been out for lunch, usually perched on a rock high above, watching the sky. Dinner in those dreams had been fish from the stream, sweet-fleshed mountain trout, lightly fried. Not this stream, it was too small, but downstream a few kilometers. She had fished there, the time she camped here for a week. Reality, not dreams, by then, the summer she was 11. The fish were as tasty as she'd imagined, but the hike back and forth had convinced her that she would have to find another food source. Papa Stefan had been furious. So had her father when he came back from the situation in Carfra. There was always a situation in Carfra. Her stepmother had panicked, convinced that Esme had killed herself. Remembering that unsavory row, Esme felt herself knotting up, the cold of the stone striking deep. She pushed herself off the rock and walked out into the sun, stretching out her arms to it. Even at 11, she had known she would never kill herself, no matter what. Had Aris ever told her father? Probably not. She would have been afraid to introduce any more tension, any more difficulty between father and daughter.
Poor Aris.
Esme closed her eyes against the sun as she lifted her face to it. She had been 6 years too late with her sympathy, 6 years too late with her shock and horror. Now she could understand how futile Aris must have felt with a stepdaughter so awkward, so independent. Esme walked down the slope to the open grass. She crouched, putting a hand to the ground. It was cool. Only on the hottest midsummer day would the ground feel warm up here, but not as cold as the rock. She let herself down onto the grass and leaned back with her hands clasped behind her head. Above, the morning sky burned blue, the exact blue that felt right, that made her happiest. She had never found that blue on another planet. Under her shoulders and back, the land upheld her with just enough pressure.
You're not making it easy!
Here and now, she could not imagine leaving Altiplano forever, giving this up forever. The horse, a few rods away, waggled an ear at her, but went on munching. She stretched out on her side and looked at the flowers, reminding herself of their names. Some were original terraforming rootstock, and others had been developed here for this particular world from Terran gene lines. Pink, yellow, white, a few of the tiny blue-violet starry ones she had privately named wish stars. She had had private names for all of them, really, taken from the plant names in the old stories, whether or not they were really related. She touched them now with a fingertip, renaming them. Pink rosemary, yellow campion, crisp white primroses. It was her valley. These were her flowers, and she could give them her names. Forever. She looked over at the horse. It was grazing steadily, not so much as an ear flick to indicate any danger. She leaned her head back on her arm again. She could feel the warmth of the sun where it touched her, and the coolness of the shadows. She felt herself relaxing, as she had not relaxed since she arrived. Or for how long before? And let her eyelids sag shut. She rolled her face into the fragrant grass to get the annoying sun off her eyelids. Esme woke with a jerk as a shadow stooped over her. Even as she lunged up, she recognized the horse. It plunged away, fighting the hobbles, frightened because she was.
You scared me!
Yes, I scared you too. Sorry.
Esme looked around. She had slept at least an hour, more likely two, and she could feel the heat of sunburn on her ear. She had worn a hat, but not when she lay down.
Idiot.
When her heart slowed, she felt better, rested. Lunch, her stomach reminded her. She walked back to the rock, shaking the kinks out of legs and arms, and then took her hat and the lunch sack back into the sun. Now she was ready for that meat pasty, and the horse would enjoy the apple. After lunch, she walked down by the stream and let her mind loose again. She had come home and found the truth, and it had not killed her. She didn't like it. It hurt, and she knew it would continue to hurt. But she had survived the first terrifying hours as she had survived the initial assault in childhood. She felt shaky, but not in danger of dissolution. Was she ready to give this up, this lovely valley that had helped her cling to sanity so often? She knelt and put her hand into the stream's icy flow. She loved this sound, the smell of the pungent herbs on its bank, the feel of icy water on her hands and face when she knelt to drink. She did not have to decide now. She had years. If she stayed in Fleet, if she qualified for rejuvenation, she had many, many years. Long after her father died, long after everyone who had betrayed her died, she could come home to this valley, still young enough to enjoy it. She could build her cabin and live here in peace. It would not have to hurt to return. She could avoid that pain just by persisting. Against this vision rose the vivid, eager face of her cousin Lucy. If she gained her peaceful valley at the end by simply outlasting those who had betrayed her, Lucy would be old, perhaps dead.
How many normal lifetimes will I live before I've earned retirement in the peace of my valley?
Esme would like to have Lucy for a friend as well as a business partner. Lucy, who now looked up to her, as she could not recall anyone in the family looking up to her before.
It's not fair.
An icy breeze slid down the creek bed and chilled her. Stupid complaint. Life was not about fairness.
He lied to me!
The horse threw up its head, ears pointed at her. He watched her with the suspicion of the edible for the eater. Esme felt her rage draining away. Not really gone, but its immediate pressure eased. She spent another hour wandering around the glade, drifting in and out of moods like the clouds drifting in and out of sight above the slopes. Finally, as the afternoon shadows began to climb the boulders, she caught and saddled the horse again. As she unlooped the hobbles and prepared to mount, the horse eyed her and flicked an ear.
Yes, and I scared you out of your wits, didn't I? You're not used to that kind of behavior from Sweezes.
The upper pastures, when she came to them, were still in sunlight, out of the shadow of the mountains. Far away to the south, she saw a drift of cattle moving slowly. In the distance, the buildings of the estancia were nestled in green trees like little toys, bright painted. For some reason, she felt a rush of joy. It passed through her to the horse, which broke into a trot. She didn't feel her stiffness. Without realizing she was going to, she legged the horse into a canter and then let it extend into a gallop. Wind burned her face. Her hair streamed back. She could feel each separate tug on her scalp, and the power of the galloping animal beneath her lifted her beyond fear or anger. The team from Special Materials Analysis came off the commercial line at Comus along with all the other passengers, some 130. Here, in the interior of the Familius, the customs checks were perfunctory. A glance at the ID, a glance at the luggage, their matching briefcases, matching duffels, all with the company logo.
Consultants, eh?
That's right.
Gory smiled at the man, that friendly open smile which was just a bit too memorable sometimes. Arhas wondered if he should have let Gory come, but Gory was the best with such devices, faster by 30 seconds than anyone else. He would edge their profit up on the fleet contract, too. 30 seconds 100 times a day was 50 minutes off the top.
What a life. Wish I could be a consultant.
The customs man waved them through.
They always think it's glamorous. If they had to be on the road all the time, hear the complaints at home.
You didn't have to marry that loser.
This was an old script. One Losa and Pratt could improvise around for an hour.
He's not a loser. He's just sensitive.
Artists. I don't know why intelligent women always fall for losers who claim they're creative.
He is not a loser. He's sold 3 works.
In how long?
Stop it. It's not important. Gory, let her alone. She's right. People think our job is glamorous, and if they knew what it's really like, on the road all the time, working long hours for people who are already angry that they had to hire us, they'd know better. But no more personal problems on this trip, all right? We're going to be stuck out here long enough without making it seem longer.
Gory cast a sidelong look at Losa.
All right.
I need to stop in here.
Losa ducked into a lady's without looking at Gory at all. Arhas glanced at Gory, who shrugged. Pratt shook his head. The 2 junior women, technicians newly hired from a large firm which hadn't offered them enough challenge, glanced at each other and made a tentative move toward the ladies.
Go on, we've got enough time.
She's the sensitive one.
Stop it. It doesn't help, and we can't run her life.
The rest of the team caught up with them and formed a clot in the passage until Losa and the other women reappeared. Then, not speaking, they moved on to the gate that divided fleet space from civilian space. Here, instead of a bored civilian customs inspector, they faced a cluster of alert, edgy military guards. Arhas handed over his ID case.
Arhas Asperson, Special Materials Analysis Consulting. And this is the contract.
A data cube, embossed with fleet's own insignia on one side, and an elaborate marbled etching on the others. It had taken them 2 years to develop a duplicate of fleet's equipment so that they could fabricate their own cubes rather than having to steal and reprogram them. Then they'd gotten this perfectly legitimate contract and hadn't needed to use their fake.
Yes, sir. And how many in your group?
7.
Arhas stood aside while the second guard collected everyone's ID cases. He would have worried, on Sierra Station, even with a real fleet cube, though they had used the faked fleet cubes before and faked ID before, fleet was unusually alert, thanks to the repercussions from Xavier. Here, he expected no trouble. And in fact, the cube reader had already accepted, then spat out, the fake cube.
All clear, sir. We have to check all the luggage, of course.
Of course.
Asperson handed over his own duffel and briefcase. Standard civilian electronics, data pads, cube reader, cubes, portable computers in all sizes from pocket to briefing, communications access sets, data probe wands. The guard held up the comm access set and the data wand.
You can't use this shipboard, sir.
No, I understand. Last time out, your people provided a shielded locker.
We can do that, sir.
Inexperienced consultants sometimes insisted that they would not give up any of their equipment. They got no more contracts. The other guard, Arhas noticed, was calling someone in fleet territory, and soon a lowly pivot appeared with a luggage truck and a lockable container for the restricted electronics.
You don't have to lock it up now. If you want to place calls from the fleet areas, that's permissible from any blue-coated booth. But before boarding...
We understand.
Arhas knew there would be another search before they boarded. The fleet area of Comus Station had its own eating places, its own bars, its own entertainment and shopping outlets, and even public rental sleeping. They had plenty of time before their ship left.